Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we parasitize your brain with weird and wonderful science. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, Shasta Henry talks about her love of insects and getting one named after her. And now news of Julian Assange's extradition hearing. Due process for Julian. Julian Assange's UK trial for extradition to the US is over. The espionage charges were that he broke an oath he never gave, to betray an allegiance to a nation he doesn't belong to, in the course of publishing the same stories as journalists at the New York Times and The Guardian, who are not being charged. The hacking charge is for attempting to break a code that's mathematically impossible to break, to give Chelsea Manning access to data she already had legal access to. Among the elephants in the room is how an Australian citizen publishing stories in the UK can possibly fall under the jurisdiction of a nation he's never set foot in. This is President Trump's administration claiming that US laws apply in every jurisdiction of the world, but US legal protections apply nowhere. Another elephant in the room is that President Trump has reintroduced a federal death penalty in the US. The espionage charges against Mr. Assange can carry a death penalty. It is illegal under the US-UK extradition treaty to extradite someone who may face the death penalty. District Judge Vanessa Baratza gave prosecution lawyers up to 4 hours to question expert witnesses, while the defence's examination was cut off at half an hour. The judge said she doesn't think anything beyond the written opening arguments will have any effect, implying that she'll ignore all of the evidence. This is not normal. The public were excluded from the court, and only a limited number of people were allowed access to the video stream, which broke down all the time. People were arbitrarily denied access to the video stream despite having all their paperwork. 40 human rights organisations had their access revoked. The judge often insisted that witnesses not be allowed to testify due to time, and only a written witness statement read privately by herself would be allowed. Open justice was prevented. This is not normal. UN Rapporteur on Torture Nils Melzer has confirmed that Mr. Assange was tortured in the Ecuadorian embassy and again in Belmarsh prison. Mr. Assange was made to sit at the back of the court encased in a thick glass box, forced to go on his hands and knees to whisper through a slot to get messages passed to his lawyers, who were seated at the front of the room. He had neither a speaker to hear the proceedings nor a microphone to participate. This is not due process. Even murderers and terrorists in British courts get to privately instruct their lawyers, but not this publisher. Mr. Assange was strip searched several times every day and made late to court, whereupon he was strongly reprimanded for being late to court and threatened with a trial in his absence. He's been drugged without knowing what the medications are. He's been denied reading glasses for months and then finally given glasses with the wrong prescription. He was denied a computer to work on his case, and when one was finally provided, the keys were glued down. He wasn't allowed to talk with his lawyers or family for over 6 months. The governor of Belmarsh Prison has been awarded the Order of the British Empire. This is not normal. The court heard how the US government hired a Spanish security agency to spy with live internet video streams on Mr. Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. They breached lawyer-client and doctor-patient confidentiality, copied legal papers and phone contents, and even stole babies' nappies to check the DNA. They discussed poisoning and kidnapping him. Ultimately, they stole all his papers and handed them to the US government. The US government have admitted to having them, but refused to return them. The papers include correspondence that Mr. Assange and his lawyers needed to reference in the extradition trial. Due process in both the UK and the US would lead to the case being dismissed without possibility of appeal, as happened in the espionage case against Daniel Ellsberg, when President Nixon had agents steal his documents ahead of his trial. Australian journalist John Pilger was one of the few journalists to sit through the whole case, and he describes Mr. Assange's treatment as due revenge rather than due process. The court heard evidence on the torture of prisoners in the United States Penitentiary Florence Administrative Maximum Facility, ADMAX. People who are supposed to be treated as innocent till proved guilty in court are held in solitary confinement for months before their trial under special administrative measures. They're allowed no human contact, exercise, or recreation. After their conviction, their torture continues until they die. Under the US-UK extradition treaty, such treatment alone would be enough for a judge to dismiss the case. The court heard how Mr. Assange's health issues incurred under torture would lead to his health deteriorating in the appalling American prison, and under the extradition treaty, this would also be a reason to dismiss the case. The court heard how the Trump administration offered Mr. Assange a pardon if he would reveal his sources for the Democratic National Convention's email leak, and Mr. Assange refused. Of course, the whole point of the WikiLeaks website is that people can leak documents anonymously, so the journalists can never give them up, even under torture. President Trump then personally ordered the prosecution to ramp up, and Mr. Assange was kidnapped from the Ecuadorian embassy. President Obama had halted his own attempts at prosecution of Mr. Assange because of the implications for American journalists to be treated the same way, violating freedom of speech. This makes the case even more political, and under the US-UK extradition treaty, political prosecution should lead to the case being dismissed. Instead, District Judge Baratza promised to only offer her decision after the US election. This is not normal. During the trial, District Judge Vanessa Baratza constantly used pre-written decisions given to her by Chief Magistrate and Senior District Judge for England and Wales, Lady Arbuthnot. Lady Arbuthnot was the judge who convicted Mr. Assange of breaching bail by seeking asylum, even though seeking asylum is a perfectly legal reason to breach bail in the UK. She, her husband and son, all work for the US and UK spy agencies as contractors and consultants, and were named for corruption in some of the documents published by WikiLeaks. The defence and prosecution must now submit their summations only on paper to the judge, so the public will never hear them. On the 4th of January 2021, having kept Mr. Assange in Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison without charge for over a year, District Judge Baratza will confer with Chief Magistrate Lady Arbuthnot and render her judgment. Some have held out hope that even if the decision is inevitably made against him, that his lawyers can appeal to the High Court. Lady Arbuthnot has just been promoted to the High Court, taking effect in February 2021. Just in time to make the decision herself on any appeal against her own extradition decision for Mr. Assange's lawyers. Totally normal. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Insects. Shasta Henry is an invertebrate ecologist, entomologist and biogeographer, doing a PhD at the University of Tasmania. She's investigating the way that alpine wildfire has impacted the places that alpine invertebrates are able to live and the communities that they form. Shasta studies bugs. I spoke with Shasta by Zoom. There are noises sort of like insects chewing and rustling that I couldn't completely remove. I began by asking her, are you looking at all sorts of insects that are affected by wildfires or just specific populations?
I am looking at all insects, in the data that I've collected from my field site. And because I'm an ecologist, I'm looking at the way that all of those different elements which make up a community, so that is quite broad spectrum. In entomology, it's not uncommon to become really, really specific, a professional in one really narrow branch of one part of the insect tree. So you'll have fly specialists, you'll have ant specialists, you'll have cockroach specialists. And I was basically just terrified of missing out. I didn't want to have to put on the blinders to any insect. And so I sit up in the ecology sphere where I get to kind of look at everything all the time.
Fantastic. And how did you first get interested in insects? Was it from a very young age?
Yes, definitely. There's a beautiful quote, a entomologist who has significantly preceded me, E.O. Wilson, which was that all children have an insect phase, and I just never grew out of mine. And I think for a lot of people who are studying or, you know, or working and living a passion, that is very much true. So, yeah, I was always interested in creepy crawlies, plants and mud and, you know, lifting up rocks, looking underneath. I spent many, many happy holidays at my grandmother's house in Bridport. Feet and my brain immersed in rock pools, poking sea anemones, seeing what would happen. I think for children, that kind of micro world, you know, lady beetles, caterpillars, is sort of the first domain that you have, you know, that you have sort of authority over. You know, you can't cross the road by yourself. Dogs and cats might scratch or bite you. You have to be cautious. You know, can't touch baby birds in nests. And there's all of these sorts of things that are designed to protect us and to protect the world from us as children. But insects, I think, either slip through that gap, or as they are largely safe, you know, we're allowed to interact with them and we're bigger than them. And, you know, you can have your first pet, probably some kind of hapless insect in a jam jar. And so I think there's a lot of that. There's almost sort of a natural synergy between children and insects.
I think you're right, for sure. I mean, it's just the kids play and they see insects everywhere, so of course.
Yeah. Which makes my other job as a science communicator, so as a teacher of old children and young children, that little bit easier. I kind of feel like I'm cheating a bit because I don't have to generate any of that interest. People are like already on board. They're just pleased that I've turned up and can answer all of their weird and wonderful questions, whereas some people kind of have to explain what they do and kind of get the hook going that everyone has seen an insect, everybody's butterflies or beetles or something. And in fact, even people who are horrified by insects, and that's no small number of people, but like I've already got their attention. So that's the hard part taken care of.
And people are fascinated because there's so many. I mean, you have the bees and the danger that we're warned about is happening with bees around the world and how we need them for our food, for example.
Yeah, so there's lots of different levels of buy-in with insects. I love to acknowledge the shallow. One of the things I really love about insects is that they're really pretty. They're really beautiful. But then there's, like you were just alluding to, there's also this like deep, integral role that they're playing in the ecosystem. That's the thing I like about ecology and being an ecologist, and studying how those systems support our lives. And then as a communicator, I like finding those stories of where insects are actually holding up part of the pillar of human society. If I'm looking for, like, a big ticket item and things like bees. Bees are pollinators. We can say pollinators more broadly, because we're also then talking about other parts of the family broadly, like butterflies, but also beetles and lots of flies. Did you know that flies are pollinators?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't like flies very much, and I just didn't like them for the same reasons that everybody else doesn't, because they're kind of gross and they're black and they're buzzy and they're annoying. But learning that they're pollinators, and now I look at them with a slightly softer eye, because they're actually often out there on flowers feeding on nectar and moving pollen around and doing that same valuable work that bees are doing, that kind of changed my perspective on them. And like you were alluding to, Hive collapse has kind of gone out of the media a little bit as some of our other emergencies have become more urgent. But as the world has changed, the world that insects have evolved to live in is becoming less stable. It's filled up with more pesticides, maybe less food resources, and climate warming or cooling changing in different ways. And yeah, we're starting to see a lot of sort of really significant pressure being put onto these perfect little robots, which are just perfectly calibrated for the world as they evolved to fit it. And as that's changing, we are starting to put really dangerous, threatening pressure onto our pollinators that create, it's a wonderful quote, it's a real snappy one, it's one in three bites of food you've ever eaten was created by insect pollinators.
Amazing. So important. As you're saying, so there's a lot of insects. It's not just bees that are pollinators. There's flies and probably lots of others that do the same role.
Yeah, well, I mean, plants are incredibly numerous, and so pollinators are incredibly numerous. They kind of go hand in hand, and practically everything on our planet is looking for something good to eat, and plants are full of it. Pollen is, you know, like high in protein and starches and those kinds of things, and nectar is just packed full of sugar, and so various insects eat the pollen or the nectar, and that's allows the pollen to get moved around. So yeah, there's far more invertebrate insect pollinators at work out in your garden than just bees. Even that little piece of information, like you switch a new filter on, and I have learned this lesson time and time again. I learn a new piece of information, I go out into the field, and suddenly it's like my eyes have been switched on and I'm able to observe. It feels like the first time some new thing that I've seen. So it's spring has sprung and the sun is coming out and all insects are solar powered, so none in winter, and we're starting to see more now that it's sunnier. So yeah, if you're into flower watching or insect watching, have a little closer scrutinize of the insects that you're seeing resting on your flowers and drinking from your flowers. And those big ugly blue bodily flies are just as valuable pollinators as the stripy fuzzy bees that you're used to seeing.
And I believe as part of your research, you've actually been part of naming an insect.
I have. So it sounds really exciting, and it is, and it's really gratifying, but I'm also super prepared to burst that bubble, because there are so many insects, A, on the planet, and B, left unnamed at this point, that you bump into unnamed insects left, right, and center. So technically, it isn't hard to stumble across an unnamed insect and then please name it. Somebody has to. There's so many of them. So yeah, I do also do work in taxonomy, which is the science of identifying and naming new species. I started out, I finished my honours here at UTAS, and I love travelling as well. And so I kind of wanted to combine travelling, maybe doing a bit of study since I was free. I'd just done a full year's committed work on a project. And so I wrote a letter to the Smithsonian and said, hey, can I come do an internship? And of course, nobody turns down free labour. So I got to go to Washington, D.C., and I was working on my first taxonomic project, studying under the beetle curator there, who had brought back a bunch of material from the canopy in the Amazon. And I spent 3 months diligently picking through them, breaking them up into groups, learning all of their names, and finding out which ones fitted into the names that already existed. And it's like when you get your Skittle packet and you open it and you put them all off into they're all into group colours, colour coding your candy. So it's exactly the same as that, but with beetles. And we found a few that didn't already have names that were different in different ways, different lengths and heights and hairs and iridescence and things. So that was the first time I got to name a species. And I worked very hard on reading the Latin dictionary and contemplating what were the unique characters of these beetles that I had been given the responsibility of naming, and finding good Latin names for them. And we'd gone through that process, and I'd come back to Australia, and I was reading through the paper that we were publishing to sort of officially connect these species to their names. There was another species in there that I hadn't seen before, and it was Hibopteria, which is the genus that we were working within. That was established a long time ago, and we're fitting new species names into the genus Hibopteria. So there's an Hibopteria Shasta. I was like, oh, that's it's a place marker word. We must be waiting to put a proper name in there. And I read through to the description, and it was my supervisor had named another one after me. So that was pretty exciting. That made it very hard to have sensible, normal, run-of-the-mill conversation in the pub at that point in time. So after that, that set off a little cascade of thoughts in my mind. I was kind of overwhelmed. And so now the paper is published, and it says that the beetle was named after the intern who was working on the project. But my name is actually Native Northern American. I'm not. My parents found it in a book, but the true origin of the word Shasta, or the name Shasta, is Northern Californian Indian. And so I was a bit disappointed that, given this platform to have studied and to be writing literature that gets published, and the case of insect names saved in the published literature for hundreds of years, if you get it right, and it doesn't have to get changed further down the line, that I fumbled that opportunity to put an Indigenous word back into, you know, in the place that it belongs. And so now, working on my PhD, and like I said, an abundance of unnamed species going begging, we decided to write a chapter on a Tasmanian unnamed species. And it's a species of big, attractive, big, I'm making signs at the camera, and of course podcast people can't see my hands waving around. It's about the size of a 50-cent piece, but more kind of oval, and looks a bit like one of those little chitons that you see in rock pools at the beach. It's got these, doesn't have wings, so you can see all of its plates that goes down its body, and it's kind of dull coppery sheen, a bit like one of those beautiful bronze statues. And they live up in the mountains in central Tasmania, up around Lake Augusta. And it was well known for a long time, but it didn't have a name. And so I picked up that species and kind of put all of the paperwork in order. And when it came to naming that species, thankfully I've had the kind of education that put me in contact with the Palo Akani language program and Riawana, which is the Tasmanian Aboriginal kind of mentorship program through the university. All of those pieces finally came together that I was able to see the opportunity to give this species the name Polyzosteria. That's the genus name that was already established. There's about 15 Polyzosteria cockroaches on mainland Australia. And the Tasmanian one, publication pending, will be called Polyzosteria yingina, and that is the dual name that was given to the Great Lake in central Tasmania. And so there was that word there and that opportunity to kind of put all of those puzzle pieces together. So that's my current taxonomic project and achievement.
That's awesome. That was part one of my interview with Shasta Henry, PhD student from the University of Tasmania, talking about her love of insects. Listen next week for part two with Shasta Henry and her passion for insects. Unfortunately, the Zoom video recording for Shasta's interview failed, but you can see many other interviews on the Diffusion YouTube channel. Subscribe and like at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including Radio Blue Mountains 89.1 FM in New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and 2XXFM in Canberra. Diffusion is now narrowcast on Indigo FM 88 in northeast Victoria. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 1,000 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/ianwolfe. Support Diffusion by buying from the affiliate links at diffusionradio.com/support. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.